And finally, Jason rose out of his seat and stretched.
"Does this tub have any coffee aboard?"
He was fading fast, but he didn't want to go to sleep until they had transitioned into slip space, whatever the hell that was. Dietz cocked its head as if pondering the question for a fraction of a second.
"Ah, yes. Ask for Trout. It's very similar to your coffee drink and has the same stimulant effect."
"Thanks,"
Jason replied as he hopped down from the command station and walked off the bridge. He was very aware that at some point during his meals and rest, his rifle had gone missing from the place where he had set it on the bridge. Initially, he had intended to ask Dietz directly about where the weapon had gone, but for now, he decided to see how it would play out. While he doubted the synth was holding it for safekeeping, he also knew it would do him no good right now as anything other than a security blanket. If Dietz meant to harm him or had any other nefarious designs regarding him, the AR-15 and its single magazine of ammo would not likely save him. He walked with more confidence up to the terminal in the galley and instructed it with a single word. "Trout."
"How would you like it, sir?"
Black?
"Processing."
He was once again rewarded with a ding, and the panel slid up to reveal a steaming mug that looked like it was made from some sort of brushed metal. He grabbed the handle and peered into it. It certainly looked like coffee, and even at this distance it had that pungent smell he recognized. He brought it to his lips and took a small, slurping sip. After letting it roll around in his mouth, he took another, and a smile spread across his face. It was similar to an Arabica blend with some subtle clove notes that left a slight numbness on his tongue. It wasn't exactly coffee, but it was damn close. One of his major food groups had been satisfied. Caffeine, or at least something close to it. If he could teach the machine to spit out a taco supreme, he'd be set. He sat down at the galley table to drink his Trout rather than go back to the bridge. "Computer," he said suddenly, "where is the original crew for this ship?"
"Insufficient detail provided. This vessel has had multiple rotations of crew members at every post,"
the computer's dispassionate voice intoned. This gave Jason pause. He really had no idea as to the history of this ship. It looked state-of-the-art to him, but it could well be an immaculately maintained antique.
"How old is this ship? Please give the answer in Earth years."
Jason felt he was on to something, or at least he had a source of information that was somewhat independent of the being that was on the bridge at the moment.
"This vessel was constructed 11 Earth years ago, and was in active military service until 2 years ago."
It could hardly be considered outdated. Jason's own truck was a few years older.
"So this ship is no longer affiliated with a military branch? Explain, please."
"The Benstrel Mining Concern is no longer a viable entity. This vessel was sold on the open market as part of an asset liquidation and purchased by a private citizen."
The ship's computer was a veritable gold mine, as it seemed to be completely unconcerned about shielding any information from him. It seemed more than willing to give him anything he asked for. Jason surmised that the ship must have been part of a private military. It was just one more clue as to the nature of the universe he'd unwittingly flung himself into. He continued his query.
"Please tell me what happened to the last crew of this ship."
"The last crew on the manifest disembarked at Ultrest Prime 39 Earth days prior and has yet to re-embark. Their whereabouts are currently unknown,"
the ship answered. Jason was quickly realizing that while the computer was not withholding any information, it also wasn't going to embellish or volunteer additional answers without being specifically asked.
"Do you know where they might be, or why?"
Jason assumed that the entire crew was not on vacation somewhere.
"Unknown."
Jason's instincts led him to the next question.
"Is Dietz part of the former crew that is currently missing?"
The synthetic being called Dietz is the property of Captain Klegsch and serves as an administrative facilitator while on board.
Property? Now that is interesting, he said. Were all synths considered property, or would Dietz more accurately be described as a slave? The conversations he'd had with Dietz as to why exactly he was needed on this current mission floated back up to the top of his mind. It seems this species wasn't universally recognized as a free people. Jason's almost compulsive need to categorize everything led him to try and draw parallels between the apparent situation of this synth and the institution of slavery on his home world. For some reason, however, he just couldn't make that emotional connection between the two. The revulsion he felt towards his own species for its treatment of dissimilar races throughout history didn't come when he thought about Dietz living in servitude. Was it because Dietz would be considered a machine on Earth? Or was it simply that the situation he was in was so outside of his normal that he couldn't apply any of his values to it? What did that say about him if his values were so arbitrary?
We're exiting your star system now. We'll be flying by a few interesting objects on our way out, if you're interested.
Dietz's voice over the intercom stirred Jason from his thoughts. He swallowed the last room-temperature gulp of Trout and made his way back to the bridge. On my way, he said, leaving his mug behind for one of the little service bots to collect. Walking onto the bridge, Jason saw that there were indeed some objects outside the canopy, and they appeared to be illuminated by something other than the sun.
I've spotlighted this asteroid while the ship completes a scan of it. All the objects out here are the leftover debris from the formation of your star system. The forward sensors flagged this one as possibly having some rare compounds that may be worth extracting while we're out here. We're not necessarily on a tight schedule, after all, Dietz informed him as he slid into the co-pilot seat.
As soon as he sat down, the displays all faded out and came back up in English, displaying units of measure he could actually understand. So, why light it up?
Actually, that was for your benefit. The ship obviously doesn't need illumination to do the scans. I surmised what part of the spectrum is visible to your species from your medical scan, and had the emitters project those wavelengths to illuminate the object.
Dietz seemed especially pleased with himself as he favored Jason with one of those odd, closed-mouth smiles. Thanks. I appreciate that.
And he did. The opportunity to view a Kuiper Belt object up close and in person was something to be savored. But it was also more than just that. Since the beginning of this trip, he had walked on Mars, looked upon Jupiter, and was now observing an asteroid tumble through the interminable blackness of space at the edge of Sol's influence. All of this wonder to behold, and while on an alien spaceship and accompanied by an alien being to boot.
Jason had met everything that had happened thus far with a childlike wonder and awe, and he was certain this innocence would not, could not, last as he left his own world further behind. The fact that he was aboard a machine of war was indicative of the nature of the universe that waited for him. A series of beeps from his displays grabbed his attention. The ship had completed its scan of the object and hadn't found anything of note, certainly nothing worth staying for. Without a word, Dietz grabbed the controls and turned the ship away from the object and began accelerating out of the system. This far up the gravity well, the ship had enough power to pull directly away without taxing the engines. The acceleration numbers, presented in G-forces on his display, were astonishing. So much so that it became abstract. Jason knew if an earthbound vehicle accelerated this fast, its occupants would be pulverized into a gelatinous mash against the rear bulkheads. Another set of warnings appeared on his display as they were still accelerating out into interstellar space. This one said, "Stand by for slipspace transition." Having been a science fiction fan for much of his life, Jason was looking forward to being there when the ship began traveling faster than the speed of light. A countdown from 5 appeared in the middle of his display and began winding down slightly faster than the Earth seconds he was used to. At 1, the canopy suddenly went opaque, and the lights on the bridge dimmed slightly for a split second, indicating an enormous power drain on the ship's power plant. That was it. There was no dramatic flash, no thunderclap of sound as the ship defied relativity. Nothing to indicate that the warp drive had engaged. Jason let out an audible,
"Try not to be too disappointed. The energies involved in propelling the ship through slipspace would be blinding to you, so the canopy automatically dims. Honestly, there isn't much to see. The ship is inside of a slipspace bubble, for lack of a better term, and won't emerge into real space until power to the emitters is cut off."
Jason sat back into his seat, still disappointed, but also thrilled as he realized he was sitting in a spacecraft that was now traveling faster than the speed of light. He stretched out and yawned, feeling very tired again. He knew his sleep cycle must be completely screwed up since there was no discernible day or night on board the ship. He stood and hopped down from the command station.
"I'm going to grab a couple of hours of sleep. It doesn't seem like there's much going on right now," he said as he walked towards the bridge exit.
"You are correct. There will be very little to see while we're traveling through slipspace," Dietz confirmed. "We'll reach our destination in approximately 72 hours. We could probably make it a little quicker, but in the shape the ship is currently in, I don't want to push the slip drive too hard. If it fails, we're stranded."
"By all means, let's take our time and not spend the rest of our lives floating through space," Jason called over his shoulder as he walked off the bridge. He made his way down to the stateroom that he had already begun to think of as his, and took the time to strip down before climbing into the bed. He was sound asleep within minutes.
Chapter 7. The next few cycles, can't really call them days anymore, ran together as Jason slept, ate, and explored the ship. He worked out in the cargo bay, poked around in the engineering bays, and spent hours talking to the ship, trying to glean as much intel as he could from a source other than Dietz, a being whose motives still weren't entirely clear. As for Dietz himself, Jason didn't see him much as he spent most of the time locked in the communications room. Jason wasn't entirely sure exactly when he started thinking of the synth as a he rather than an it, but the more time they spent together, the more a pronounced masculine character became apparent. It wasn't that the synth was overly macho, or even that the timbre of his voice couldn't also belong to a female. It was something more intangible that Jason interpreted as male gender-specific. The topic of gender within a society of constructed beings might be interesting, but for all Jason knew, it could also be highly taboo or offensive in some way. While he was curious, that curiosity wasn't strong enough for him to risk being stranded light years from his home. It was after a vigorous heavy gravity workout in the cargo bay that Jason was specifically addressed by the ship for the first time.
"Passenger Burke, the ship is approaching the target destination. 4 hours until transition to real space," the computer told him. A soft double beep let him know that there was nothing else forthcoming over the intercom.
"Thanks. Where is Dietz?"
Jason didn't know if he was being foolish thanking a computer or not, but it never hurt to err on the side of politeness.
"The synthetic Dietz is heading towards the bridge."
Jason wondered what Dietz had been doing while locked up in the comm room. He walked back to his room to grab a shower and change into clean clothes before heading up to the bridge himself. The shower had been an interesting adventure unto itself. It operated on jets of pressurized mist and seemed to adapt itself to his body chemistry. The first shower had been overly hot and left him feeling oily all over. The next had been much better, and by the third day he was left feeling more clean and refreshed than after any earth-based shower he could remember. He assumed that the first few attempts had been from the shower still being set for the room's previous occupant, which did alarm Jason somewhat. Glad the last guy in here wasn't a species that took sulfuric acid baths. Once showered and dried, he grabbed his new clothes off the bed. He was quite proud of his new threads. He had managed to program one of the ship's fabricators to produce them himself. Well, mostly with the help of the ship's computer, if truth be told. The clothes closely resembled the uniform he had worn in the military, but instead of a terrestrial camouflage pattern, he had opted for a flat, dark gray that matched the interior bulkheads of the ship. The boots were a soft, black synthetic material that resembled suede leather, and the pants were bloused over them. The base layer was even more impressive, however, as it incorporated technology not found on Earth. While it resembled the newest commercially available base layers that were designed to wick away moisture, these undergarments were also capable of regulating his body temperature by monitoring heat and perspiration, and adjusting the material temperature accordingly. Jason could see no discernible power source, yet he could feel it cooling off as soon as he put it on, compensating for his still elevated skin temperature from the workout in the cargo bay and the hot shower. After donning his new uniform, he made his way to the bridge by way of the galley, although they were in opposite directions, and grabbed a mug of Trout. Wishing for a touch of vanilla creamer to go with it, he took his drink with him as he ambled up to the bridge. Nodding to Dietz as he walked in, he paused to look at the main canopy. It was still blacked out while in slip space, but now the entire surface showed an enormous holographic projection of a planet, ostensibly their destination, and some scrolling data alongside it. Over that, a timer counted down to what Jason assumed to be their arrival. He slid into his seat next to Dietz and watched as his displays came to life. It looked like they had a little more than 2 hours remaining until they made orbit. He hid his grin behind the mug as he took a drink. The excitement was building the closer the ship got to the first exoplanet to be seen by humans.
So, what's this planet called?
He really did expect some exotic, unpronounceable name with a ton of consonant sounds.
Breaker's World.
You said what?
Jason knew he had to be mistaken, or Dietz's translation was off.
Breaker's World. You look horribly disappointed. What were you expecting?
Dietz was looking at him with his metallic brow furled.
Well, something a little more... I don't know.
Jason was floundering while Dietz just stared at him with one brow cocked. He moved on.
So, what does that name mean?
Dietz slowly turned back to the displays.
Presumably, someone called Breaker colonized it. It's not a very important or even useful planet by most standards. While it's a nice, medium-sized rocky world with an atmosphere, it's also pretty far out in the spiral arm. Also, for some reason, non-indigenous crops will not grow there, nor are the local plants edible by most species. So, Breaker's World is largely ignored by most governments and corporations, which makes it attractive to certain parties who like to work in private.
That sounds like said parties are engaged in less than legal activities, Jason said.
Dietz gave a non-committal shrug and continued to watch the displays. As the countdown timer reached zero, the ship gave a barely perceptible shudder, and the canopy returned to fully transparent as it streaked into the star system, now flying in real space. There was nothing of note outside the canopy, however. Just a nondescript starfield that could have been anywhere. As Jason strained his eyes to see anything outside the ship, his console beeped and the section displaying navigational data went from having a red border to green. The scrolling text announced that the ship's location had been verified, and then a stylized representation of the star system came up showing the location of both Breaker's World and the ship in relation to the primary star. It looked like they had dropped out of slipspace just outside the heliopause, well away from the system's equivalent to the Kuiper Belt. After days of hearing the constant drone of the ship's slipspace drive, the bridge felt deathly quiet once it had shut down. Jason assumed that there were either safety or procedural reasons as to why they had exited slipspace so far away from their destination, so he didn't bother asking Dietz. A few minutes after all the displays had greened up, Jason could feel the main engines fire up and watched the acceleration indicator in front of him climb. The rumble from the four mains was distinctly different than the more high-pitched whine of the slipspace drive. Eyeing the holograph of the star system, Jason noticed that they wouldn't pass close to any other planets on their way to Breaker's world, so he ignored the view outside and set about reconfiguring his console now that he had a better handle on how to get the computer to do what he wanted. Once he had the display showing all the information he felt was pertinent, and in units he understood, he was dismayed to find that they were still 16 hours from reaching orbit, even at the incredible rate of acceleration they were achieving. "Not a chance in hell I'm sitting here for 16 more hours literally staring off into space," Jason said. He hopped out of his seat and headed for the galley without a word to Dietz, who, for his part, didn't even acknowledge that Jason was leaving the bridge. Chapter 8. Jason stood on the bridge of the gunship and gazed at the planet below through the canopy. His face was a stoic mask of calm and confidence, sentiments that were the polar opposite of how he really felt. The alien planet, while similar, could never be mistaken for Earth. The land masses were obviously different, but there was a slightly greenish tint to the oceans rather than the deep blue of his homeworld.
"I'm the first human to see another planet outside the solar system. Well, probably, if you don't believe any of the alien abduction garbage."
They had been in a slowly decaying orbit while waiting for clearance to land from the surface, so Jason had been given the opportunity to get a good view of it in its entirety as they orbited the planet multiple times. He was excited beyond belief to get down on the planet and poke around. But there was also a sense of apprehension, as the real reason for him even being there was quickly approaching. If Dietz had tricked him for some nefarious reason, he would soon know. Adding to his discomfort, he felt itchy all over, a side effect of the inoculations he had been given in the medical bay. They would ensure the alien microbes on Breaker's world didn't overwhelm his system and cause serious problems once he was on the surface. With the limited facilities on the ship, Dietz told him that he would still probably feel like crap for a few days afterwards, but that would be the extent of it. After a few more orbits, he heard Dietz talking to the surface controller in a language he didn't understand. He assumed it meant they would be landing soon, so he made his way back to his seat. He had no sooner sat down when he heard the engines throttle down and noticed the nose pitch over towards the planet. The indicated velocity on his display began to decrease. As the ship descended altitude, a mild buffeting could be felt through the seat and plasma strings began to dance along the forward collision shields. Soon the entire canopy was awash in superheated gas as the engines throttled back up and pushed the big gunship down into the atmosphere. They eventually leveled out around 35,000 feet. And banked gently north, away from the equator. Jason noticed a conspicuous lack of civilization below them as the ship roared north at twice the speed of sound, so he asked Dietz about it.
"This planet has two fairly large moons that anchor its rotation, but when their orbits overlap, the tidal forces can trigger seismic activity around the planet's equator. There's nothing there but rainforest, so it's largely left unsettled. By the way, this planet has a slightly higher oxygen content than you're used to on Earth. Not by much, but enough that you may notice the effects."
"Better too much than too little," Jason mused out loud as he watched the alien landscape pass by.
Soon, Jason could tell that they were descending towards what looked like a fairly well-developed settlement. With the ship's artificial gravity and constant pressure, it wasn't like descending in a commercial airliner.
There were no physical sensations other than the visual cues from the displays and the view outside. Dietz cycled the landing gear and swung the ship around over a large airfield and brought it to a rock-solid hover 30 feet off the tarmac. After a short conversation with the ground controller, he eased them around and over their landing pad and touched down. Jason stood up and walked back over to the canopy as Dietz shut down the engines and put various systems into a standby mode. When he was finished, he looked up at Jason. "I have a gift for you." Saying nothing else, he rose and walked off the bridge with Jason in tow. They wound their way down to the lower deck, through one of the engineering spaces, and into the armory, a place Jason hadn't been allowed to explore during the trip. He looked around in surprise at the amount of infantry weaponry that was on board the vessel, but his eyes were instantly drawn to the workbench on the far wall, and what was sitting on it, his AR-15 that had gone missing. "Rather than try and bring you up to speed on the finer points of energy weapons, I decided we'd stick to what you know," Dietz said as he hefted the weapon. "I modeled this after the chemical propellant slug thrower you boarded with."
"So that isn't my rifle,"
Dietz continued. "This magnetically accelerates a tungsten carbide projectile at hypersonic velocities. It's strictly a kinetic weapon, so your line of sight aim is just as critical as before. It feeds the projectiles out of a detachable magazine like you're familiar with, but this magazine holds 150 rounds as well as the power pack." It took a moment for the significance of Dietz's sales pitch to sink in. "Holy shit, it's a handheld railgun," he exclaimed. The amount of destructive force even a small projectile at hypersonic speeds could unleash was awesome. It both thrilled and terrified Jason to be able to hold that much power in a package the size of an M4. Jason grabbed the weapon and noticed immediately that it was nearly half the weight of his rifle. The barrel was also quite different. The diameter was so large it looked almost like an integrally suppressed M4. The foregrip appeared to be the same as the modular rail grip he had on his own weapon, but it felt distinctly non-metallic in his hands. "The fire selector works the same as your own rifle. It has two settings, off and fire. There's also an emergency mode button behind that that will allow the weapon to fire continuously as long as you keep it and the trigger depressed simultaneously. However, it will not only deplete the power pack rapidly, it will also permanently damage the barrel. This was a bit of a rush job, so I didn't have the opportunity to design a cooling system for such a small unit." Dietz was watching Jason's face as he continued his explanation.
"This is absolutely incredible, Dietz. But why upgrade me to such a powerful weapon?"
Jason snapped the railgun up to his shoulder and sighted down through the optics. As soon as he did so, an active display lit up and began feeding information about whatever he sighted on. "You're my backup on this run," Dietz was explaining. "No matter how unlikely it is that it will be needed, if something happens, I'd like you to be able to provide some level of defense for me." Jason fixed him with a sour look. "And yourself," the synth amended quickly. After snapping the weapon up to his shoulder a few more times to get a feel for how it seated into his shoulder and the eye relief, Jason set it back on the bench and began to attach the single-point tactical sling that had been sitting next to it. He noticed right away that this item was his from when he'd originally boarded the gunship. "I also have taken the liberty of making body armor that will protect your vital organs," Dietz said as he walked across the armory to a closed wall locker. The mere mention of the words body armor brought a sneer of disgust to Jason's face as well as an involuntary shudder. He remembered his heavy, hot, smelly plate carrier that he'd worn during his multiple tours in the Middle East. While necessary, it was an unpleasant proposition nonetheless. As with his new weapon, he should have known that any armor produced by the ship's miraculous fabricators would have next to nothing in common with the clunky plate armor of his recent past. When the door to the locker slid back into the wall, he was looking at what closely resembled the lightweight chest protector a motocross racer might wear, albeit with a little more coverage. It also looked to be made of some sort of composite material and reflected the light oddly as he viewed it from different angles. Jason stood patiently and waited for Dietz to explain the apparatus to him. "It'll protect against moderate impacts and also has an ablative layer that should protect against most energy weapon blasts that you'd expect to encounter on this planet," Dietz was saying.
"Should?"
Jason wasn't sure he liked the sound of that, but kept his misgivings to himself as the synth helped him into the armor. He was quite pleased at the diminutive weight and the full range of motion it allowed. The outfit included not only the chest protector and pauldrons, but a set of hard-shell gloves and forearm and thigh protectors that strapped on. He looked at himself in the full-length mirror in the armory and was immensely happy with the overall effect. The dark gray of his new uniform went well with the shimmering, darker gray-black of the armor. While he was a firm believer in form over function, every warrior still liked to look like a badass.
"If you're happy with the fit, there's one more thing we need to take care of," Dietz continued, walking over to another touch panel terminal that looked like it had been added to the bulkhead as an afterthought. "This terminal, for lack of a better term, is the ship's treasury. I'll need to add you to the access list in order for you to be able to authorize payment for our cargo delivery and secure its release. This is the main reason you're here."
Dietz activated the terminal and then spoke aloud to the ship's computer.
"Computer, please add Jason Burke to the crew manifest and grant access to the treasury terminal."
"Jason Burke, human." After a moment, the computer asked,
"What rank will be assigned to crewman Burke?"
At this, Dietz paused and looked at Jason speculatively.
"First officer."
"Confirmed. Commander Burke has been added to the crew manifest and has been given the appropriate levels of clearance to the armory, engineering, and treasury." As the computer called him Commander Burke, a thrill went up Jason's spine, and all of a sudden, he was 8 years old again.
"Jason Burke, Space Commander."
He smiled to himself as he enjoyed a moment of pure adolescent joy.
"There, that should grant you enough privilege to perform your task," Dietz said, completely oblivious to the human's overt display of joy. He had a knack for ruining a moment.
"Thanks," Jason said dryly, slinging his weapon over his right shoulder.
Commander Burke followed Dietz to a door that was not the one they had entered through. This one was quite a bit larger and much more formidable in its construction. Once it was keyed open, Jason immediately recognized the ship's cargo bay. This was the lower door he had seen earlier that he hadn't been able to open during his subsequent trips into the hold. That made sense now. It was direct access to the armory from the cargo bay and rear loading ramp. After the pressure was normalized to outside ambient, slightly lower than what it had been during the flight, and the ramp began to lower, Jason's excitement was dampened by the wash of smell that assailed him from the open cargo bay door. It had a sickly sweet tang to it that was quite strong. He grimaced. Dietz looked over and explained.
"Every planet has its own unique smell, some more pleasant than others. You get used to it after a couple of hours."
The pair walked down the ramp and onto the tarmac. Looking around the spaceport, Jason couldn't help but be struck by the similarity between it and any modern airport you would see on Earth, complete with an elevated control tower. He wondered if he should be armed or not. But Dietz had made no move to stop him as he walked out of the armory with the new railgun.
"I need to go and secure delivery of our cargo. It would be expected that I would be the one to go and handle the details," Dietz explained. "I'll be back well before it arrives, and we'll talk you through what you need to do to both accept it and make the payment. I've also scheduled engineering services to come out and complete the repairs on the drive emitters and slip reactor. Again, I'm sure I'll beat them back.
For now, just stay here at the foot of the ramp or inside the cargo bay, and try to look like you belong here.
The synth then turned and walked towards an approaching vehicle that looked oddly similar to an oversized golf cart. Once the vehicle drove off and was out of sight, Jason walked the perimeter of the ship, both as a security sweep and to get a complete view of the area. He was beginning to get bored of walking around the cargo bay when a loud yell from the bottom of the ramp nearly made him jump out of his skin. He turned and saw a strange little being staring at him with large black eyes and hesitantly waving at him with a six-fingered hand. Despite having been on the ship for a while and talking to Dietz for hours about alien cultures, seeing his first biological alien in the flesh set his heart to pounding. Trying to appear like this was old hat to him, he gave a friendly wave and walked over to the little guy.
"Gal?" "Hello there. Can I help you?"
The being's oversized pointed ears fluttered like bird wings, and it cocked its head to one side. It then answered in a language that Jason had not a prayer of trying to decipher.
"Oh, boy."
Now that he was closer, Jason could see that though it was short, the alien was solidly built and had dark blue skin. It had a small mouth and a nose that was not nearly as prominent on its face as Jason's own. Despite the exotic color and appendages, it didn't look that alien. Bipedal, bilateral symmetry, and sporting a set of black coveralls that looked like they belonged on any mechanic. Jason realized it must be from the engineering service Dietz had called. The being eyed the rifle nervously and repeated the noise it had made before. When the human shook his head helplessly, it tapped at its own ear and then pointed to Jason's ear. Not understanding the meaning, Jason dumbly shook his head again, wondering if the universal headshake for negative was really all that universal. The alien approached and peeked around both sides of his head before emitting another bizarre sound and walking back down the ramp and out of the ship, seeming to grumble the whole way. Following it outside, Jason saw it had arrived in what looked to be a work vehicle. It pressed a couple of buttons and the side began to fold up and over, revealing a workbench and rows of tools. After fishing around in one of the open top bins for a second, it walked back towards Jason with something in its hand, the whole time still jabbering away in its own language, punctuating certain words with a flutter of its ears. It handed the device to Jason and then pointed at his ear again. Understanding what he wanted, Jason held the device up to his ear. As soon as it made contact, he could feel it begin to meld around his ear shape until it was securely in place. After this, the alien waved for Jason to follow him back into the ship. Marching up to the terminal by the door, it pressed a spot on the screen and spoke up into the air. Almost immediately, the computer responded, but to Jason.
"Commander Burke, stand by while the interpreter unit is uploaded with the human English language translation matrix."
The device in his ear beeped softly.
"Better?"
The voice in the earpiece was imposed over the alien's actual vocalizations. The effect was a bit disconcerting.
"I can understand you, if that's what you mean,"
Jason answered, realizing for the first time how completely unprepared he was for this moment. Dietz had given him no instructions regarding etiquette or what could be considered an insult.
"Ah, that's better. My name is Twingo. I'm the engineer that's been dispatched to take a look at your grav emitters and the primary reactor."
Now that the translation was coming through, Jason sensed a prominent gregariousness to Twingo's personality. He was still talking a mile a minute as he looked around the cargo bay.
"Haven't seen anything like this around here in a while. Not too much call for gunships anymore this far down the spiral arm. Looks like she's taking a bit of a beating. Ha! So what's the other ship look like?"
Jason noticed that the ear flutters seemed to emphasize certain points he was trying to make. Twingo walked up to the terminal without waiting for an answer to his questions and began plugging away at it. Unlike when Jason first touched it that night and it locked him out, It responded immediately and began displaying menus that the engineer could navigate through. He consulted with the terminal in the cargo bay as well as a tablet computer he held in his right hand, harumphing to himself occasionally as he pored through the scrolling displays. It was a good 5 minutes later when Twingo switched off his own tablet and looked at Jason.
No problem. Need to realign the emitters and then calibrate the fuel flow to the reactor. Your output was so low because the matter-antimatter ratio was off. That will kick the reactor into an emergency safe mode that can't be overridden until a full calibration is performed.
Jason wasn't aware the reactor output was low, or how it worked, or where it was. So he just nodded and smiled knowingly.
So it's something you see a lot?
He asked the question more to feel a part of the process than any real curiosity about Twingo's workload. The engineer, however, took the question very seriously and, in an eerily familiar way, looked up at the ceiling and rubbed his chin while he thought it through. Jason saw that the six-fingered hand actually had two opposable thumbs, one on each side of the four middle digits.
Not on something like this. We get our fair share of clunkers and scows that the prospectors in the area try to keep in flying order, but most people with a warship this expensive already have an engineer as part of the crew.
Jason pointedly ignored the unasked question, so Twingo continued on.
I didn't get your name anyway. It looks like you're not from around here. What manner of creature are you?
Jason could tell the question was intended with good humor, so he took no offense at the word creature.
My name is Jason Burke. I'm a human, although I doubt you've seen any of my kind before.
He didn't elaborate on much more than that. He keenly felt his responsibility to keep Earth a closely guarded secret.
Human, eh? Can't say that I have. Two names as well. Interesting. Not rare, but still interesting. Anyway, from your lack of implants, I assume you're new to the space lanes?
Twingo didn't press him more about his origins as the unlikely pair walked back down the ramp towards the engineer's vehicle.
Implants?
Yeah, you know, computer interface implants, translator implants, memory implants. All manner of gizmos you can have installed into yourself nowadays. I myself just had my eyes done so I can see in an expanded spectrum. Great for my line of work, although I had a week of terrible headaches afterwards.
Jason was fascinated by the idea, although he was now wondering why Dietz had neglected to give him a translation device before he left. The ship certainly had to have a couple on board. Hell, the one he currently wore was rattling around in someone's toolbox a short while ago. The two passed the time with idle chatter as they waited for the specialized equipment and personnel Twingo needed to effect repairs to the gunship. Soon, another vehicle hummed to a stop next to the ship, this one about the size of a tractor trailer one would see on American highways. Two beings jumped out of the front, dressed similarly to Twingo. One was obviously the same species, while the other was something different. All its exposed skin was covered with a sleek-looking grayish fur, so it was difficult for Jason to make out any real detail. Both nodded respectfully to Jason and then went directly to Twingo for instructions. Out of habit, Jason was resting his right hand on the grip of the weapon slung around his shoulder. He realized that this may be taken as a threatening posture, so he removed his hand and adjusted the sling so the railgun now hung down and slightly behind him. His instincts proved correct, as both of the newcomers visibly relaxed and went back to talking to Twingo and looking at technical schematics on the tablet. The work was well underway when Dietz finally made an appearance. Even with a metallic face and no clothes, the synth looked frazzled and worried. This, in turn, tightened Jason's stomach up.
Problems?
Huh? Oh, no, no problems.
Dietz seemed even more evasive than usual. He looked at the progress being made by the technical team. They currently had transmission lines of some sort running from the larger ground vehicle to each of the long slip drive emitters that made up the trailing edge of the gunship's wings. In turn, the emitters were glowing bright blue and a pulsating hum could be felt. Every so often, the crew would run the power up a bit and loose debris on the tarmac would lift into the air and levitate until the power came back down. Twingo, for his part, had a few large access hatches open in the ship's belly and was utilizing some sort of hovering lift to maneuver himself and his equipment around and up into the openings. The previously boisterous alien was grunting and cursing as he worked to get the reactor back in shape.
So, did they say how long they'd be?
How exactly would I ask them? Jason had given Dietz a pass on many things. But leaving him standing alone on an alien planet with no means with which to communicate rubbed him the wrong way. Dietz looked over at him, and his eyes traveled up to the earpiece Jason was wearing.
Oh, I suppose it slipped my mind that you would need a translator. So, if you're quite done being peevish, did they say how long they'd be?
The synth was already watching the crews, as if silently willing them to hurry. From what Twingo tells me, it'll be another 2 or 3 hours. We in a hurry all of a sudden? Something had changed. Jason could feel it. And whatever it was didn't seem to be in their favor.
We're always in a hurry, my friend,
Dietz boomed expansively, startling Jason.
After all, time is money in this business.
With that, the synth walked over to talk to Twingo.
And I'm beginning to wonder just exactly what that business actually is.
True to his word, the engineer had the ship buttoned up and ready for flight a few minutes under the 2-hour mark. His pair of helpers had already left, and Twingo was chatting with Jason as he packed away his equipment. The sun was beginning to go down, and Dietz was seemingly in a hurry to get the talkative alien paid and on his way. But the engineer seemed more interested in conversing with Jason than making a hasty exit. The pair were still talking when an unmarked ground vehicle pulled up. This one was quite large. The vehicle pulled smoothly to a stop and backed up to the gunship. Jason watched with interest as the rear ramp of the ship raised slightly and then retracted completely into the fuselage, leaving a gaping hole that led into the cargo bay. The ground vehicle's cargo section then lifted on a set of hydraulic rams and backed up further until it was butted up against the cargo bay floor.
Looks like whatever you guys are taking on isn't meant to be seen, Twingo observed as he leaned against his own vehicle.
It would appear so, Jason agreed.
He had begun to suspect that any legitimate enterprise the synth was involved in wouldn't have necessarily needed him, which left only illegitimate ventures. Not for the first time, he fervently hoped he wasn't crossing the line from boring, law-abiding citizen of Earth to interstellar criminal. After a few short minutes, the vehicle that had delivered the cargo had pulled forward, and the cargo ramp reappeared and lowered to the ground. Jason stood up straighter as Dietz motioned him forward while he walked towards the front of the large delivery vehicle.
Let's pay these guys quickly so we can leave, he said quietly. Just let me do the talking. All you'll have to do is press your finger onto a tab display to confirm payment transfer, and then we'll be on our way.
As they approached the front of the vehicle, two short, squat beings hopped out and walked, or waddled, up to them. Dietz took the lead right away.
Gentlemen, let me introduce you to Commander Burke. He's in charge of the ship at the moment. I assume everything is in order?
It is as far as we're concerned. Confirm here.
Skipping all pleasantries, one of the aliens shoved a thin tablet into Jason's midsection. When he looked down, he froze up. While the translator he wore allowed him to understand their spoken language, it did nothing to help him read the document he held. Dietz sensed his hesitation and jumped in.
Everything should be in order, Commander. No need to waste your valuable time rehashing over all the details. Just press your thumb in the confirmation circle, and these fine gentlemen can be on their way.
There was only one circle on the screen. With a look to Dietz to try and discern any deception on his part, Jason pressed his thumb into the circle and held it. The tablet beeped, and some more scrolling text he couldn't read flashed in the middle.
Ah, excellent!
Dietz grabbed the tablet and handed it back to the alien who had jammed it into Jason's stomach.
Pleasure doing business with you, gentlemen,
Dietz was talking to their backs. The moment they had the tablet back in their possession, they took off as fast as their little legs would carry them. As soon as the vehicle pulled away, all traces of good humor vanished from the synth's face.
"Let's get out of here,"
was all he said as he walked at a brisk pace back to the ship. Jason didn't see the first blast, but he heard it. The second, however, exploded against the tail of the gunship, sending a cascade of sparks showering down around them. He dropped down and began scanning in the direction the energy blast had come from, and saw a dark ground car speeding towards them from the far side of the complex. He watched as two more bolts shot out from the vehicle and splashed against the hull of the ship, creating a lot of noise and sparks, but doing no damage other than a scorch mark.
"They're still out of range."
Jason heard and registered Dietz's words, and was also aware of the bizarre, agitated screams coming from Twingo. The vehicle had closed to around 300 meters and was coming fast. Dietz took aim with a handheld weapon that seemed to appear in his hand from nowhere and let loose with a brilliant green beam of energy. The return fire hit the vehicle head-on but diffused harmlessly against the front of it. Dietz sneered in disgust and fired three more shots in rapid succession with the same results.
"It's shielded!"
Jason, having been in combat before, was charged with adrenaline and fear, but was completely in control. When Dietz fired first, he took that as a signal he was clear to engage. He brought his larger weapon up to his shoulder and flicked the switch to fire. He could hear a whining from the weapon as the optics fed him information on range and speed of his target. It was an easy shot, since, although hauling ass, the vehicle was coming straight at him.
"Here goes nothing."
He let out his breath and squeezed the trigger, not sure what to expect. The resulting roar and pressure from the hypersonic projectile leaving the barrel was tremendous. Ears ringing, Jason watched transfixed as the single round tore through the vehicle with devastating effect. The front seemed to fold in on itself, and the rear lifted off the ground violently. The end result was a tumbling, flaming wreckage, which screeched to a halt still 100 meters away. Even Dietz was momentarily stunned before yelling at Jason,
"Let's go! We need to be in the air now!"
As he followed the synth at a run towards the ramp, he looked over and saw a motionless heap near the maintenance vehicle. Twingo.
"Leave him!"
Dietz didn't even slow down to see if Jason listened before charging up the ramp. Jason, however, would do no such thing. Since he had no idea how to check for vitals, he simply grabbed two handfuls of coverall and swung the little alien up over his shoulder and ran for the ship, charging up into the cargo bay. As the ramp came up, he could hear and feel the main systems coming online. Jason secured Twingo to the same infirmary bed he had once occupied and instructed the ship's computer to begin necessary emergency treatment since it seemed to know what species he was. He then dashed out towards the bridge as articulated arms began to descend from the ceiling.
"What the holy hell was that?"
Jason wanted answers as he jumped into his seat and allowed the restraints to snake out and around him, pulling him gently but firmly back.
"No time for that now,"
Dietz replied, hands flying over the controls and barking commands to the ship.
"The reactor is at full power, but the emitters aren't charged yet. We can't initialize the grav drive until they are, and we've got more company on the way."
Jason could see on the display in front of him that they had inbound targets, and from the looks of it, they were dealing with aircraft this time.
"So we're sitting ducks?"
"Oh, no, we've got plenty of surprises for our new friends, but shooting our way out of here won't endear us to the locals."
Dietz grabbed the helm controls and fired up the mains.
"We'll be using brute force to get out of here, so it's good that you have your restraints on."
The gunship began to vibrate forcefully as the ventral repulsors began to lift the big craft off the ground.
"Cycle landing gear,"
Dietz said to the computer before pushing the controls forward. He was rewarded with a resounding boom as the four powerful main engines lit off and shoved them forward violently. The internal grav plating was active, but Jason could still feel the acceleration as the gunship raced along the ground, gaining speed and allowing the airfoils to get some bite into the thick lower atmosphere. The comm system lit up with multiple requests, demands, that they land and surrender themselves, all of which were promptly ignored as Dietz pulled the nose up and the powerful ship clawed for altitude. Jason kept his eyes riveted to the tactical display that made up most of his center console. They had three supersonic bogies bearing down on them, but they were quickly losing the initiative as the gunship roared into the darkening sky, the thundering of the main engines probably terrifying any unfortunate soul they overflew. He touched one of the bogies in the holographic projection, and instantly the sensor data the tactical computer had collected appeared on a screen to his left. Although the name the computer gave was unpronounceable to Jason, there was no mistaking the shape. They were being pursued by a trio of sleek, ferocious-looking aero fighters. He glanced over at Dietz and took some small comfort that the synth looked completely unworried. And after a few moments, it became clear why. The aircraft giving chase had stopped accelerating once they had reached Mach 3.2, but the much more powerful gunship was already reaching hypersonic velocities and was nearly out of the planet's atmosphere. A few more minutes and we'll be able to switch over to the grav drive and kill the mains. And with the reactor at full power, we can enter slipspace within the star system. It doesn't appear that we're being pursued at the moment. The smug expression on the synth's face irritated Jason greatly for some reason.
Chapter 9. So who was that shooting at us?
Apparently not anyone very competent, Dietz replied glibly.
After looking at the expression on Jason's face, he continued more seriously.
Just some people who failed to understand the finer points of property ownership. Our cargo is a hot commodity. Some must have figured it would be easier to steal it from us on the ramp than to try to break it out of the secure storage it had been in.
Do I even want to know what we're carrying?
Probably not.
Whatever, Jason said, letting it drop, for now.